This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Kevin Penkin, whose most recent project is Florence. And hey, it's so much fun to have a chance to talk with you.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be on.
You know, Florence is such a beautiful game. It's very simple on the surface, and yet it takes the player on this incredible emotional journey as this young woman, Florence, is experiencing her first real love affair with this cellist named Krish. And it's just so bittersweet and heartbreaking. And Ken Wong is one of the lead designer. He was the lead designer for Monument Valley as well. And it must have been such a fun project for you to work on.
Well, the team at Mountains created just this insanely beautiful game. Not even talking about the music for a second, but I think just as a work of art, I think they've done an incredible job. To be part of it, on top of that, has been a really fulfilling experience. Amazing team to work with, very expressive, and also an Australian game, which as a fellow Australian, I find a very big point of pride.
Oh yeah, I can imagine. And it got so much wonderful exposure, I guess, because it's a really unusual idea. I'm not even sure you can call it a game. It's certainly not a game in the traditional sense, because it's really more like a graphic novel. And I know you've done music for films and for TV shows, anime, that kind of thing. So was this, the process of writing the music for this, a little more similar to that?
Well, it's strange because when I start writing music for whatever it may be, I don't, the core concept never has a lot of influence from what it may be, whether it be an interactive piece of work, whether it be anime, TV, film, etc. So the core concept will always sort of be quite, for lack of a better word, pure. And then from that, I'll sort of start looking into why or how we might implement or show this music for this project in that particular sort of medium or something like that. So it never really started out as, is this a game? Is this a comic book? Is it a film? It's just sort of like, okay, this is Studio Mountains at their best. And let's see what we can do with that.
And so what was there for them to tell you about in those early discussions?
We only started talking about a couple of key things. Intimacy was one of them. And we also started talking about the representation of characters through instruments, namely the two main characters, Florence and Krish, the love interest of the game. And so talking about how a piano and a cello can interact with each other was a big topic of early conversation. And then from that, it sort of slowly started getting refined, and as the aesthetic started like naturally rearing its head as we moved on and sort of started getting more into the project, that's when things started to really feel like they were coming together.
Yeah, I can imagine. And it must have felt like such a great opportunity, because Florence is wordless pretty much, and so it's kind of like in the tradition of Journey and Abzu, and so the music does a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of, you know, creating and reinforcing emotion and that kind of thing. And yet your music is so wonderful because it doesn't club the player over the head with what they should be playing or feeling, which is just fantastic. So how did you eventually come to the point where your music honestly is just such an awesome fit with the game?
Well, thank you. I don't know what to say. well, first off, Journey and Abzu, two fantastic games with one very fantastic composer. So it's in some good company if you're comparing it to that. I'm very appreciative of that. But to answer your actual question. Because, as you said, Florence is a wordless game, barring some very incidental dialogue that doesn't actually have anything to do with the core narrative or the core story of Florence, there were times where we would use melody as a catalyst to have these characters speak to each other. And it's interesting because I actually felt that, and I haven't just felt this in projects that I've worked on, I've seen it in other examples as well, where wordless or languageless sort of dialogue between two characters or two players or whatever it may be can actually have a very profound meaning and impact, because you're actually bringing sort of whatever you interpret these communications to be into the story or into the game or whatever it may be. And so being able to play with that a little bit and sort of get involved in that sort of abstract approach was actually very, very gratifying, and actually, yeah, it presented some pretty interesting challenges at times, and also was I actually found it very expressive in a weird way.
Well, First Dates is a really great example of how that all works, because your music has the same kind of, sort of tentative and a little bit disjointed quality. The mechanic in the game, the way Florence and Krish are getting to know each other, you have to put the puzzle pieces in their word bubbles, and when it starts out, the puzzle pieces are, there's a lot of them, and it's kind of complex, and the conversation that you wrote for the cello and the piano is equally complex, and then the more comfortable they get, there's a kind of a flow to the music as well, and so it just reinforces that so perfectly.
Well, you got to really hand it to the game design there, because it's such a smart way to tell a story with zero words and relatively simple gameplay. Yet it's refined in such a way where it, like you said, regarding the music, but I'll say this regarding the gameplay, it doesn't club you over the head with anything. It just shows you how to do it, and then it allows you to figure it out. And what's really nice is that if you see like sort of these Let's Plays or things like that, and you see people have that aha moment at a couple of these chapters in Florence, and it's very, very gratifying. And I can only imagine it's really gratifying for the team at Mountains as well to see these playthroughs and say, oh, now they get it, or to see these people basically have this sort of, yeah, epiphany. It's like, oh, this is actually exactly how it really goes in real life. And they're explaining it in a really smart, sophisticated, refined way, but in nothing that says that you must feel this way or you must think this way now. It's just very, very organic, very, very smart gameplay.
It really is. And I think all of us who play it overlay our own experiences about having the very first time we fell in love. We've got all that emotional baggage that we
I think we've all been there.
As the story progressed and you knew what was going to happen to Florence and Krish, you must have gotten really emotionally involved in their story too, I would imagine.
Well, I think we've all had that sort of one relationship that was like our first sort of almost like, it's like the first time you feel like you've emotionally matured in terms of a relationship, maybe. I remember my first proper relationship, and it, you know, like all first relationships for most people, it doesn't end up going how you think it was or how you think it would, and you've got to learn to let go of that, and that's another massive sort of personal journey that you go through. So there was a lot of experience, not a lot of experience, but there was some experience to sort of draw upon and say, okay, I remember feeling this loneliness, or I remember feeling this anguish, or I remember what it was like to fall in love as well for the first time, like properly fall in love, or at least, you know, your best definition of love at the time. And being able to try and express that in music hopefully makes it a more personal journey as well.
Oh, yeah, of course it does. And there's that moment when Florence, she spends a lot of time on her phone looking at photos and retweeting things and talking with people.
I know how she feels.
I know, me too.
Yeah.
But it's funny because then her phone dies and she takes off her headphones and notices this music that Krish is playing. And I just love how you bring that music in. And I think anytime you hear live music, you know, we hear music all the time from everywhere, but to actually see somebody playing it is really attention grabbing. And so that's just such a great moment in the game.
Well, it was really rewarding to record as well, because I live in London now, but I'm from Western Australia. And I remember I had the last recording session on the day before I came back. So I finished like 7 p.m. one day, and then the next day at 6 a.m. I was on the flight back, so I was editing takes on the flight. And I remember, even just like with the world's worst headphones, flying back pretty tired, listening to the live musician play was so rewarding, because it felt really genuine, really honest. And knowing that that was about to replace a fairly standard synth cello on a phone, and then people were going to listen to it and then potentially have a very profound reaction to it, was a very, very sort of satisfying moment for me.
Did you write for a particular group of musicians, or, well, first of all, who are the musicians, and then how did you track them all down?
So it's a bit of an interesting story. So we started with piano and cello, because those were going to represent the two main characters. And then as we were starting to sort of fill out the soundtrack and start composing some of the chapters, etc., we got to a point where we knew that we wanted to start experimenting with different colors and things like that. And so there was a point, basically, where we started looking into other sort of solo instruments to help out. Clarinet was one of them, flute and violin, basically, and some electronics. So it was interesting because, for practical reasons, we had to record in Perth. I was, by the time that we knew when we needed all this, all the music done, I knew where I was going to be physically in the world at the time, and I knew that there was going to be the best opportunity we were going to have is to record while I was back for Christmas. And so, just for a bit of quick background, I did my undergraduate degree at the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts, which is shortened to WAPA. So I had done a degree there. I had many friends there. I'd worked with Perth musicians for a long time. And so I started calling friends, basically. And some of these people were former teachers of mine. The flute player, Diane, she taught me when I was like 10. She taught me flute. And so it really came full. So I remember, actually, it's funny because I went over to her house once to have a lesson. And at the end of the lesson, she turned to my mum, who was coming to pick me up, and she said, "Look, he's very talented, but he's not going to be a classical musician. He was a lot more interested in my son, who was a similar age to me, playing Zelda Wind Waker on the GameCube in the other room." So you could kind of see where that was going. I'm glad she thought at least I had some talent, but definitely classical flute was maybe not going to be where my calling was going to be. But she played flute. She came in, and that was amazing. The piano player, Noelle, she's a dear friend of mine. We went to Whopper together, and Noelle's great. She's a close friend, so you know, I know that I can call her up and be like, "Hey, so if I brought over like 3 bottles of wine and showed you a game, would you be keen on playing some piano for it?" And she's like, "Yeah, bring it over." So you know, 3 bottles of wine later, I'm showing her the game and being like, "Okay, so this is where you need to be really sad," or whatever. So it was a really fun experience because I got to use friends, I got to use former teachers, and I got to use musicians that I worked with in the past as well. So it was a very genuine, fun experience, sort of writing and also recording for this. And everyone did insanely well. I mean, remember, Australia in December is about 35 degrees Celsius. I'm not sure. It's probably about 92 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. And so it's because it's summer. So we're sat in the studio for 2 days recording for hours on end. And I'm not when I say I'm not the easiest to work with, I don't mean that like I'm ratty or anything, but I'm looking for a very specific sound. So if I know that musician can get it, I'm going to push them in a very productive way, hopefully. But they were absolute troopers, and everyone seemed to have a great time. Just super tough sessions to get everything down, but they nailed it.
I have so much respect for session musicians because they they can just go in there, and a lot of times if they don't nail it on the first try, it doesn't take long, and they're incredible.
I know. Yeah. Exactly. What's crazy is that this was I think it was Noelle's first ever recording session, I think, and I'm not sure if anyone else had. I think other people have done recording sessions, but the fact that everyone was such a trooper, and like you said, they pick it up so fast.
Yeah, because I'm absolutely hopeless at sight reading, so I just really admire anybody
Well,
who can.
Join the club.
So much of the music sounds as though it was really improvised. It feels so fresh and so spontaneous as you're playing the game, but I'm sure that wasn't the case. But were there times when you just let them improvise?
They, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, improvise too much. What normally happens is that they will play something in a different way than I intended it. And I will come back to the improvisation thing in a second. But what I will say on that point I was just saying now is that it tends to be the case that someone will make a mistake. Someone will make a happy mistake, and I'll say, "Oh, what's that?" And then they'll say, "Oh, well, I accidentally, you know, tapped the side of the cello as I was going to play the open C string or something like that." But actually, can you purposely make it more aggressive now so that you get some of that sort of weird sort of tapping noise or something like that? So there are instances where, especially talking about texture, I'll listen out for something that I didn't think of that a live musician will just do because it's their instrument. I mean, I come from, as I was saying before, a flute background. I play a little bit of piano and I play saxophone as well, but I don't play string instruments. And so when I'm writing for strings, it's an approximation of what I think is going to be based off as much experience as I have at the time. But it's not going to be the same as someone who's played cello or violin or even piano for, you know, decades. And so you're relying on that musician to bring their expertise. And I do definitely ask questions. And I do say, like, "What does it sound like this?" Or, "Do you have a suggestion for playing techniques, for example? Is there something I haven't thought of that will make this a more interesting sound or a different sound, something that gives it a little bit more personality?" So, you know, things like Collegno will come into the picture, Bartok Pits, etc. We'll have a pretty decent conversation about it, and I try and keep it open, so I try and keep it spontaneous in the session.
Yeah, which is so cool. And speaking of, you know, getting interesting sounds from the instrument, we're kind of getting ahead in the story a little bit, but Florence and Krish have a fight, and it's a really significant fight. And the way you handled it with the music is just so interesting because, again, it has that kind of disjointed, they're clearly not on the same page or in the same place with this experience. And the cello really sounds like it's speaking. So how did you coach the cellist to get that sound?
So for context reasons, I'll just say that this particular part of the game involves putting together little puzzle blocks, which triggers a sound. So there's a background sort of loopable background sort of piece of music going, and then you have all these very short, 4 second long-ish sort of incidental sort of not jingles, what's the word? Stingers. Little stingers coming in, which simulate speech. And in this case, it's a fight, so it's more aggressive playing. The music is more aggressive by nature. And so, well, first off, I had to write it in a way where it would maybe make sense from a musical perspective, but at the same time, needed to be completely independent of one another. So we would record all these little things individually. So when we were recording them, especially with the cello, we would go in, I would say to Sophie, the cellist, I would say, okay, I want you to maybe have a little bit more emphasis on this first note because it's a bit lower, so it sounds a bit more, you know, whimsical, or it sounds a bit more sort of pained or strained maybe. And at times, you know, especially with a lot of very aggressive tremolo, for example, as I was saying kind of abstractly before, you know, she would accidentally hit the side of her cello with the bow as she was going in to play one of these low aggressive tremolos at, you know, triple, quadruple F or something like that. And that would be the take that I would want because it has this extra thing about it that it's not just a tremolo. It's an angry, overblown, sort of out of control tremolo, which I think, at least for that particular part of the game, felt appropriate.
It almost sounds like the way you're describing it is how voice actors work, because more often than not, they're recording their lines all by themselves and they don't have anybody to bounce the dialogue off of. So they just have to kind of imagine what the reaction is going to be.
See, it's funny you say that because especially when I was younger, and I still do this, although I have slightly less time for good reasons, but I have slightly less time to do this now. But especially when I was younger, I loved going online and I loved watching video interviews with composers. It didn't really matter who the composer was. Of course, I had my favorites, but I really liked hearing them talk on camera or, you know, on podcasts or something about their process and about how they go about writing a piece of music for, you know, media, film, whatever. And so it was interesting because I think there was one interview with Hans Zimmer where he was talking about how he casts his musicians like actors, which I found very interesting. And so it started me on this sort of idea of, okay, you've got to pick who you're working with or how you're working with these people very carefully, because it is sort of like using voice actors. And, you know, it's not that like one musician is necessarily more skilled than the other, especially at that level. But it's more about finding the right person and saying, okay, well, I think you are perfect for this particular job, but maybe, you know, the other person, I think you're amazing, but I think there's going to be a different thing down the road that I think your playing style or the way that you can coax certain sounds out of your instrument will be more appropriate for something down the line or something like that. I hope that made sense.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And Austin Wintry has told me that he has kind of a core group of musicians that he goes to time and time again because he knows what they can do. And more often than not, the same thing happens as happened in your recording sessions because they're the experts. And so they can bring different sounds, like you said, that you didn't really imagine when you were just working with the samples. And so, yeah, once you get those relationships going, you can return to them time 100%. And
time again. So, yeah. 100%. It's funny because I feel the same way about recording studios sometimes. You know, there are certain recording studio environments that will elicit certain sort of personalities, if you will. For example, like this was recorded, like I said, in the dead middle of summer, 35 degrees Celsius in a small room, one person at a time. So that there was a very specific, intimate sort of sound to not only the room, but also the players and also where they're coming from. You know, everyone's rocking up in, not that this is unique to Australia or Perth, but everyone's rocking up in flip-flops or whatever. And everyone's in like summer clothes and it's just like, oh, okay, yeah, cool. Yeah, this seems fine. All right, let's just do it, whatever. Like super chill. Whereas like, you know, sometimes it's a bit more formal, you know, it's like, hi, nice to meet you. Here are the 30 musicians you're working with today. You don't have time to learn the names. Let's just do it. Okay, great. That's fine. And that will just elicit different results. One is not better than the other, but you do get a lot of personality out of both whatever particular musicians you're using and also the room that you're working in, maybe the country that you're working in as well.
Well, definitely, because you had mentioned that you recorded your soundtrack for Made in Abyss in Vienna. And so that must have given a completely different atmosphere to the recording. I mean, just, you know, the music history that's in Vienna and working with Austrians rather than working with Australians.
Well, it's funny. I mean, well, Vienna versus Perth, like they're both literally and metaphorically worlds apart. But you're very right, because the thing with Vienna, especially the room was designed for about 130 people, and I used 19 musicians. It was just a very custom chamber orchestra. It was, I think, yeah, it was three violins, three viola, two cello, one bass, then two flute, two clary, one bassoon, and then two horns, a trumpet, a trombone, and a tuba. And everyone had their own solo part as well. So it was basically up to 19 lines going at the same time. The idea behind that is to do with the story of Abyss, because Abyss is about these two kids that go down into this giant fun pit of death called the Abyss. And it's this giant cave system, which sort of almost looks a little bit like Dante's Inferno. If you look at some of the analysis videos, it's like, yeah, okay, I could see where, you know, this sort of idea came from, at least. It has a lot more complexity than just that. I'm oversimplifying it. However, the idea that, you know, it's a small group of people in a very large space to mimic the visual sensation of two children looking over this enormous vista felt appropriate. And yes, of course, the musicians as well were very, very different. Actually, it's funny, the bass player was actually from Australia, though. So it was funny because, yeah, everyone had quite distinct German or Austrian accents. And then all of a sudden, I talked to the bass player. I'm like, you're from Australia. He's like, yeah, I'm from Australia. I'm from Melbourne. I'm like, great. Awesome. I got one sort of ally, so to speak, one Australian ally in the room. So that was, it was a great session. It was a great session. But like you said, very, very different to let's say one person being recorded in a small studio in Perth.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I think probably having a small ensemble in such a big hall must have kind of reduced the amount of processing you needed, because the big echoing space was already sort of there, just sort of by design.
Oh, the early reflections are insane in the Synchron stage in Vienna. Absolutely insane. There's this one track from Abyss that has a solo cello. And at some point, the cello is just doing these two eighth notes quickly, sort of like a slide up, like da-da, like that. And it just repeats that one da-da over and over again. And it sounds insane, because here's the thing. You're recording not only, of course, close mics, but you're recording the entire room as well. And if you amplify the room sound, you basically get this almost like a weird chorus effect where it sounds like 5 to 7 celli at the same time, but it's just one person playing like two notes.
That's amazing.
It's really interesting, super interesting. Yeah, that was a good day.
Are there any other cues in Florence that you were especially proud of, or kind of maybe surprised you with how they turned out?
Well, there was a couple of cues where I think I definitely screwed the musicians a little bit, but they still really came through. I mean, because I think it's Happy Together, where it's quite a few celli, pizzicato and arco legato lines combined with, I think, two pianos and violin. And there's syncopation everywhere, which I've talked to classical musicians about this, so I don't think I'm generalizing too much. But syncopation and classical musicians sometimes have a little bit of a headbutting contest. So that's always been an interesting sort of task to complete, because I love syncopation, and then we get to the sessions, like sometimes it takes just an extra take or something like that. But to bring that all together was really gratifying, because there's a lot of lines going on, there's a lot of counter melodies, etc., and everyone just really came up to task and nailed it.
There's one cue in particular that just, oh my gosh, it just tore my heart out. Letting Go, after, well, I don't know if I should spoil it or not.
Spoiler alert! Nah, it's okay. It's been out for a couple of months now. They've had their chance. Or pause the podcast and go play it. It's like 30 minutes.
Right, exactly. So yeah, things don't work out for Florence and Krish. And she's walking by herself, and gradually in the game, the visuals in the game, he fades away and she's walking by herself. And you've done the same thing with the music. The cello is there at first and then it just gradually fades away as well. And it just, like I said, it just really got to me. And so there's not a question here, but I just wanted to bring that up.
Well, I will say as an anecdote, well, first off, thank you. That's very, very kind of you to say. And then, actually, no, I've got like three anecdotes. So first off, thank you. Props to, again, the team at Mountains for making a really, really smart gameplay decision. Because it's interesting because, as I was saying before, I've seen a couple of these gameplay, like sort of playthroughs online. And then people at first don't figure it out. And then all of a sudden they do. And yeah, they have this, especially because obviously if you're letting go of someone, it is a bit of a gut punch emotionally at that point in the story. And so seeing their reaction was very satisfying in a Schadenfreude-esque sort of way. The beauty of recording music and being able to work in this medium is that you can manipulate things in a slightly different way than just pure live music, because the ability to fade the cello out over sort of some very subtle, sort of slightly uneasy electronics, and also just play with like reverb settings and stuff, like push the reverb as he's getting away or something, small techniques like that can really help you sort of get drawn into these sorts of experiences, especially a very sort of pivotal moment in the game, which is this letting go.
Like I said, it's really, really powerful. It makes me sad every time I hear it, but, which is, you know, the power of game music because it has such strong memories from, you know, what was going on in the game. But it's a great cue just on its own, too. But you don't get the whole emotional impact unless you've kind of seen how it works in the game.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah. So you were lucky enough to work with Nobuo Uematsu. How did that all come about?
Who knows? No, I'm kidding. I'm very grateful to be able to say this story or tell this story in the first place because, especially during my teenage years, Uematsu was a huge idol of mine. I got interested in Japan very early, probably about like 10, 11 years old. And, you know, my idea was like, oh, I'm going to go work for Nintendo after I graduate high school or something like that. And obviously things took a slightly left turn in a very good way. But, you know, that passion for Japan was very raw and potent in my teenage years. And with that came anime music and game music. And when it came to anime, it came to Studio Ghibli at first. And when it came to video games, it came to Nintendo and Final Fantasy. So Uematsu-san was a huge inspiration and a huge sort of idol, basically, especially during my teenage years. And being able to meet him, I managed to meet him in Seattle in 2009, I think it was. I think I was on the tail end of high school at the time, and I managed to get over and managed to give him like a little demo disc, because apparently I thought that was the key to everything at the time. How we grow up. But but anyway, sorry, to try and keep on point a little bit, because I told you I'd ramble. I told you I would ramble. But I would go on holidays to Japan a little bit, because in Australia, because our summer holidays are at the in December, so it's only winter, it's winter in Japan, but we'd have this big 2-3 month long summer holiday. I would save up all year, I would go, and every time I went over to Japan, I would meet him, and I would meet his manager as well, a gentleman by the name of Hiroki Ogawa. And we would meet, or we would get a little coffee, something like that, maybe some food. And at some point, I think the second or third time I'd done this, like Ogawa-san, Uematsu-san's manager, he said, look, we have this small game, or small to medium-sized game. It was massive for me at the time. But we have this game from Japan, just to be released in Japan. It's a visual novel game, funnily enough. And yes, there's a bit of a history with visual novel games and myself. But he said, look, Uematsu-san's going to write the main theme, and we'd like to know if you'd like to write all the other music, as well as also arranging his main theme for this game. And, you know, I thought that was it. That this is like as good as it's going to get. And so I did this job with him, and that started quite a few projects actually with him in the following years. This was like 2010, 2011 that we started doing this sort of stuff. And yeah, right up until about like 2015, when I started moving over and doing a lot more sort of school-based work, or started doing more like Australian games or anime, something like that. We did like two or three projects very similar to those, where he would write the main theme and I would arrange that, and then in addition to that, I would write the majority, or if not all, of the underscore for these small visual novel games from Japan. So that's how it sort of started. That was the starting pistol.
Oh, that is so cool. So is there anything now, I mean, you must have learned a lot from him. Is there anything that you are still using, any techniques or ideas or concepts that he shared with you that you're still using now?
Well, when I first got this job, obviously, when you go from, oh, I'm writing maybe the occasional score to a local short film, or a small game from Perth or something like that, when you go from that level where you're, you know, friends with uni, something like that, to, oh, this is something that is international, this is someone who I adore as a musician, I hope I don't screw this up. You sort of, you know, it lights a firework under your butt a little bit. And so very quickly, I started adapting basically to rigorous deadlines, and things weren't so chill anymore. It's like, oh yeah, I'll get it to you when I get it to you. No, it's like, this is the deadline. These are the parameters. So a lot of the technical sort of know-how started with these first couple of projects, because you had to be on time, you had to be professional. This was no longer just a fun school project, as fun and as great as they are. This is paid work. You need to be professional. Okay, got it. Let's adapt. Let's go forward. And so that was one thing that's always stuck with me. I've always tried my absolute hardest, and I think I've done okay, to be as professional as possible with, of course, deadlines. I mean, that's such a duh thing to say, but to make sure that all your ducks are in as much of a row as they can be. But from the creative side, consistency was basically what I learned very early on. And this was because the second game that I did with Uematsu-san, where he wrote the main theme, was a visual novel game called Norn 9. And the game itself was one entity, and we did the game and then moved on. However, this series called Nor 9 ended up coming back as an anime, which was my first ever anime that I did. And so I had to basically remember how to write the themes and use the songs, or not songs, sorry, but the sonic signatures that I was using in Norn from a couple of years ago. So it's just funny that, you know, something that I did with another composer in 2012 or something like that came back in 2016, I think. And yeah, four or five years later, something like that. And had to basically relearn how I was writing at the time with Uematsu.
Wow, that's very cool. So yeah, you must have had to sort of, I don't know, reverse engineer it or something to
Pulling up the old Logic Pro sessions were not fun. But it worked out. It worked out okay.
Yeah. Well, and you used that consistency in Florence too, because there are two cues that are very similar, and they both illustrate kind of the same moments in her life where, as an adult, she's in a really, really boring job that is very repetitive. She's an accountant. And then when her relationship with Krish gets to the point where they're just so comfortable with each other that they're just eating pizza on the couch, there are a lot of parallels between those two cues.
Sure. Well, Ken, that's actually thanks to Ken, because one thing I will say is I was surprised with Ken how sensitive he is to music. He is very specific about sound, about tempo, melody, key signature. We talked key signature on quite a few tracks. I was over, I mean, obviously they're in Melbourne. I'm in the UK, but I was over in Melbourne for the Melbourne International Games Week last year. And that's the first time we met in person. I stayed a couple of extra weeks because I wanted to write music while in the office with them. They have a space in what's called the Arcade, which is a shared creative space for game developers in South Melbourne. And so I would literally just call him over and be like, hi, I've got this sound that I want to use. I have this one thing. Do you want to check it out? And he'd be like, oh yeah, maybe just a little less bright, or can we just change the melody a little bit? And it was this really interesting sort of organic experience. So when it came down to where we would place music, or like how we would place music, he would come up with these really interesting ideas. Like, why don't you just make a sad version of this track, or why don't you just change it in some way which might be appropriate. And so his ideas were on point, like seriously on point, very, very impressive stuff. And so while I would always present some ideas or something like that, it would always be this very detailed and, for lack of a better word, very intimate sort of collaboration between Ken and myself, obviously with other team members involved. For example, the audio director of Florence, Fabian Malabello, the guy who got me the gig, and a very, very close personal friend of mine, he would come in as well. But my conversations with Ken, which would normally happen very late at night, London time. So I'd be like pretty tired, like, hi Ken, how you doing? Yeah, pretty good, thanks. Like, he'd just be, waking up, ready to go, full of energy. Yeah, so this is okay, yeah, that sounds really good, man. I'll get to it tomorrow. So, but it worked. If we were in the same room, it happened like butter. And even over Skype, especially after meeting him at the International Games Week in November of last year, like he's really on it and he knows what he wants, and it was a very, very cool experience to work with him.
I bet. Wow, that's very, very cool. And we should mention, I mean, there are some obviously heartbreaking moments in the game, but eventually Florence rediscovers her creative side and she has a chance to be the artist she's always wanted to be, which is really fantastic. And so I was and I was kind of wondering, when you were growing up, I mean, and you were obviously very, very interested in music, were your parents supportive? And I was just wondering, because when I told my parents that I wanted to go to music school, they kind of rolled their eyes, but eventually they said, okay.
No, I get you. It's funny because I have many, many friends like that who it's not even about the fact that they want to do music, but it's normally to do with the fact that, oh, well, how are you going to earn a living? I think at least one category of this issue or problem or scenario would be that a lot of parents probably just want their kids to have enough money to survive and to be comfortable. And music is not something that people go into to be comfortable, at least for a very long time. And people are very aware of the fact, I'm not sure if people are very aware of the fact that actually probably at times, yeah, you're going to be financially in trouble, because it's not an easy gig, and you're gonna have to get a part-time job at times. I've done it. I know many other friends that have done it, if not everyone. I think Robin Williams made a joke in one of his stand-up shows where he's like, oh, Dad, I want to be a comedian. That's great, son. Just make sure you get a backup career like welding. So, like, those conversations probably happen a lot. And, I will say that I was very fortunate that when I had decided at the age of one that I was going to be a musician, and I say one because apparently, not that I have any memory of this, but apparently I was that kid in the shopping store humming stuff as they walked down the aisle. So thinking that I was that kid is a little cringeworthy, but apparently, according to my mother, I was that kid. So apparently it was pretty set that music was going to be a thing from an early age, and so they were very supportive, although they basically said, look, okay, you want to do this, that's fine, you got to make sure it works. Okay, I understand. But that is still like a really lucky scenario, considering that I do know way too many friends that have been either just flatly rejected, being like, why would you want to do that, get a real job, or, oh, well, you've got to make it work, but you've got to make it work by yourself. Having a financial backing for this career is difficult to achieve, especially if you're on your own. Funding, of course, is so important, but funding is less and less available, especially for young people at times. Thankfully, the game industry does have some really interesting schemes to be funded right now. There's quite a few projects that I know are going to be submitted to Film Victoria, for example. And so there are funding bodies for games, but young musicians sometimes can be really left on their own. And thankfully, technology has gotten to a point where you can create a fairly decent track with sort of a little amount of technology, expensive technology, that is. So I think the other aspect that is really important is also the emotional support. Musicians are historically not the most emotionally stable people. and that's putting it very lightly. We are insecure, most of us, or we're just nuts. And so I think having the emotional support is probably the most important thing. And at times, at least when I've talked to other friends, has unfortunately not been there. And that is something that I think I wish there was a way that we could tell young musicians, like, I know it feels like crap right now, but it will get better. You've just got to put the work in. I mean, anyone who's an artist tends to be pretty self-critical. And that's probably why, you know, any form of rejection, whether it be emotional, financial, or something like that, we take it so, so hard. But hopefully we will be in a place where, even though financial support might be few and far between, there's an online or even just like a local community of people who can encourage them, each other, to keep on sort of pushing for a career that probably has, what, like a 5% success rate or something like that, in terms of having that as a career without having to do side work to pay the bills.
Well, I'm so glad it worked out for you. And like I said, I am just absolutely loving your soundtrack for Florence. And Kevin, it's just been so much fun to talk with you. I really appreciate your time.
No, not at all. I hope I haven't rambled too much.
No, not at all.
That's good. I really appreciate you having me on. I've listened to your show for a while now, and it's really nice to have a chat to you. Thank you.